Follow him. Come upstairs, Melissa. I'm Nick, by the way.
I follow Nick up the stairs to the second floor. This motel could definitely use a paint job, and it's almost frightening how much the stairs creak as I walk up them. This motel could use a new everything. We pass rooms 201 and 202, and then we come to a stop in front of room 203. The door is still slightly open from when he must have changed the sheets. He drops the key into my hand.
Here you go.
I glance over his shoulder into the tiny furnished motel room, at the hard bed, and to the tiny TV, and the small window. Do you have anything for dinner here? He shoots me an irritated look.
I can make you a sandwich.
Is it included with the price of the room?
I suppose it will have to be, since you didn't even have enough money to pay for the room.
I look down the hallway behind him at the two closed doors, rooms 201 and 202. Is it possible that my sister occupied one of those rooms? It's time to find out. Is anyone else staying here? He raises his eyebrows at me.
I respect your privacy. Maybe you could respect the privacy of the other people staying here.
With those words, he turns and leaves me.
Wow,
that guy really didn't like me. I'm not sure why, because he seemed belligerent from the second I came into the hotel. Maybe it's not me. Maybe he's having a bad night. I enter the tiny motel room and shut the door behind me. I turn the lock, but then I notice a deadbolt as well. I swing it into place. The double bed is just as uncomfortable as it looks. I shrug off my coat and settle down onto it, and a spring jabs me in the butt. I adjust the pillows behind my back so I can sit up, but these pillows have seen better days. There are three of them, and they're all flat as a pancake. My phone rings. I reach into my purse to pull it out, and Rob's name is flashing on the screen. Undoubtedly, he's wondering where I am. If I tell him I went off looking for Quinn, he's not going to be thrilled. But I have to tell him something. I take the call, and immediately I hear crackling on the other line.
Claudia?
Hi, Rob, I say. Listen, I'm sorry about taking off. There's somewhere I had to go.
Claudia, I...
There's a good 5 seconds of nothing but crackling.
What? Can't hear.
I'm looking for Quinn, I say. I'll be back late tonight, I promise. There's more crackling, and then the line goes dead. I guess the reception is still bad after the storm.
Oh well.
I answered the phone, so at least he knows I'm not dead. I settle down on the bed, and I bring up the internet browser on my phone. Now that I have some privacy, I can read about the Baxter Motel. I click on the first link, which is an article from 2 years ago. The headline jumps out at me. Woman found murdered in New Hampshire motel. The woman in question was 25-year-old Christina Marsh. She was discovered dead in one of the motel rooms. Stabbed to death. There were no signs of forced entry. The article notes that the owners of the hotel, Nicholas and Rosalie Baxter, were working with the police to find the perpetrator. I read the articles one by one, and the story materializes. The woman, Christina Marsh, had been staying at the hotel for about a week. She hadn't left her room in a day, so Nick Baxter went to check on her. He discovered her lying dead in a pool of her own blood. Several of the articles mentioned a relationship between Nick Baxter and Christina Marsh. One went so far as to call her his girlfriend and implied the affair had been going on throughout her stay at the motel. He was never charged with anything, at least not according to any of these articles. And I would assume if he had been convicted of murder 2 years ago, he wouldn't still be working here. So I'm guessing he was cleared. I look down at the bedspread underneath me. Did it happen here? Was she killed in this very room? I shove my phone into my purse. I'm supposed to be focused on Quinn, but something about this place makes me feel very uneasy. I need to do what I came here to do and get out. I crack open the door to the hotel room. The hallway is empty. Quiet. I slip into the hall and look at the other two rooms. 201 and 202. This motel isn't much bigger than my house. I try room 201 first. There's a do not disturb sign hanging from the doorknob, but I ignore it as I rap my fist gently against the door. No answer. Then I knock again, harder. Nothing. Then I try the doorknob. Locked. I feel this crawling sensation on the back of my neck. I whirl around, just in time to catch somebody staring at me from room 202. A watery blue eye. Some silver hair. Having been caught, I panic and scurry back into room 203. I close the door behind me and throw the deadbolt into place. My mind is racing. Room 201 is obviously empty. Room 202 has a guest in it, so Quinn could never have been staying there. That means I should get back on the road. I'll just wait a bit longer, to give myself more space between me and the police. I figure I'll watch some TV, but I don't see the remote control anywhere. My eyes fall on the dresser next to the bed. Maybe the remote control is in the drawer. But I open it up and all I see in there is a copy of the Bible. Then, as the drawer shifts, I see a spark of something shiny from underneath the Bible. I push the Bible aside and that's when I see it. A wedding band. My hands are trembling as I pull a gold wedding band out from the drawer. It looks like the one that my sister wore for the last 2 years, but there's only one way to be sure. I tilt the band to the side and look on the inside. Wrapped around the inside of the band, I see the engraved letters Derek plus Quinn. Quinn was here, in this very room. I lift my eyes, which make contact with the window. There's a house overlooking the motel, a rickety old two-story house, and there's a light on in one of the second-story windows. I can make out a silhouette of a woman sitting in front of the window, watching. I shiver and almost drop the wedding band. The sight of this woman staring out the window has unnerved me. I look down at the wedding band in my hand. I need to get the hell out of here. No, not yet. And then I hear a single knock at the door. Chapter 24. The sound of the knock makes me nearly jump out of my skin. I just stand there for a moment, unsure what to do. I don't really want to open the door right now. But maybe it's Nick with my dinner. I should check. My phone buzzes on top of my bed. I glance over at the screen. It's the police station again. I let it go to voicemail. After another moment of hesitation, I pull the door open. I almost gasp with relief when I see there's no one there. I look down. A plate containing a sandwich is lying on the ground. The sandwich has been hastily assembled. The top slice of bread is barely on top of the sandwich. I pick up the plate and examine my dinner. It is a turkey sandwich, nothing more and nothing less. No mayonnaise, no lettuce. No tomatoes. Just dry turkey and bread. But it's free. Beggars can't be choosers. Then again, I wonder if it's safe to eat. This guy who owns the motel, Nick Baxter, may very well be a cold-blooded killer. And it's clear he doesn't think much of me. Maybe I shouldn't be eating anything he gave to me. I raise my eyes, and that's when I notice the door to room 202 has cracked open again. It's open just enough that both watery blue eyes stare out at me. She startled me before, but now I'm ready for her. "Can I help you?" I say. The door swings open further. Now I can see that the blue eyes belong to an elderly woman. She has long white hair and a deeply creased face. When she speaks, her voice is like sandpaper.
You are feistier than the other one.
I suck in a breath. This woman saw my sister here. Maybe they even talked. I drop the plate on a dresser inside my room and step into the hallway. What other one? Her ancient lips curl into a smile. What other one? I say louder this time. And then she slams the door in my face. Great. I want to say to hell with her and get out of here, but I can't do that. Quinn was here. I have a feeling Quinn spoke with this woman, and maybe this woman knows something. I've got to talk to her and figure out what she knows. Then I can leave. I grab my purse and step across the hallway. I knock firmly on the woman's door. There's only silence on the other side. So I knock again. Excuse me, I say. I'd like to speak to you. Silence. Please. I bring my face closer to the door. Listen, the truth is, I'm looking for my sister. I think she was here. Can you help me? The silence behind the door is endless. Finally, I hear locks clicking open. The door creaks as loudly as the stairs as it swings open. The woman is standing there in a long white nightgown, peering up at me.
You say you are looking for her?
She asks me. I squeeze my hands together. I want to know what happened after she left the motel.
Do you?
I nod. Can I come in? Her eyes narrow at me for a moment, but then she steps aside. My heart is racing, telling me this is a mistake, but I keep moving. I enter the old woman's room and allow her to lock the door behind me. Chapter 25. This room is nothing short of terrifying. It's all the mirrors. It's likely about the same size as my room, but mirrors cover every inch of the walls. It's like I'm in a funhouse. I'm afraid I'm going to walk into the wall without realizing it, especially considering how dark it is in here.
My name is Greta,
the old woman tells me, fixing her blue eyes on me. For the first time, I notice she has an accent, something East European. I'm Melissa, I say. Her eyes darken.
We tell the truth in this room, or else you leave.
She looks like she means it. I clear my throat. Fine, I'm Claudia. Greta gestures at her bed, and I sit gingerly on the edge, clutching my purse to my chest. She sits beside me, her eyes luminous in the yellow light of the room.
She was here, your sister, Quinn, right where you are sitting.
When?
Only hours ago.
I run my fingers along the sheets as if I could almost touch her presence. You spoke with her then?
Yes, and so did Nick. The police were here looking for her, and Nick lied to them. For her.
I was wondering why the police drove past me without having discovered Quinn here, when they obviously had been looking. Now it all makes sense. That guy Nick lied to them. No wonder he was so squirrely when I came in. That was nice of him.
It was. But Rosalie did not like it.
Who is Rosalie? The name sounds strangely familiar, like one I heard recently. She smiles thinly.
She is his wife.
Right, that's where I know the name. I saw it in all those articles. Rosalie Baxter, the co-owner of the motel. The one whose husband cheated on her and then his mistress ended up dead. Is Rosalie here? I ask. Greta shakes her head.
She does not leave her home. She is always at the window. She is always watching.
I shiver. remembering the silhouette of that woman in the window of the house next door. Do you know what happened to my sister? Greta is silent for a moment, as if debating what to say next.
She did not leave.
So is she still here? Is she in room 201?
I did not say she is still here. I just said she did not leave.
This is like one of those ridiculous riddles, like what goes up and down without moving? The stairs. What do you mean?
I think you know what I mean.
I shake my head, my stomach sinking. Greta stands up from the bed. She's so tiny, yet somehow her presence fills the room. There's something about her.
I read your sister's fortune, she says. It was very dark. Her past was dark, and her future was even darker.
Dark? She turns to look into one of the mirrors. Her reflection stares back at me.
I'm talking about death, Claudia. There was a death in her past and death in her future. And the worst part.
I hold my breath. What?
It was emanating from her.
Greta's voice is a hiss,
like a stench. Or a virus infecting everyone around her.
This woman seems like a crackpot, but there's something about her. She knows something. How do you know my sister didn't leave? She turns to look directly at me.
Go outside. Go to Rosalie's.
Rosalie's what?
Not what. Where? To Rosalie's.
I frown. You mean to the house?
No, not the house, but go.
She holds up her wrinkled hand.
I have told you all I know.
Have you? She just stares at me, her chest rising and falling under her nightgown. I rise from the bed. Because I'm not sure you have.
Go,
she says, more firmly this time. Maybe she does know more, but it's clear she has no intention of sharing it with me. Whatever I'm looking for is outside of this motel, and I'm going to find it. I take my purse and my coat with me when I leave my room. I also keep Quinn's wedding band tucked away in my pocket. I have no intention of coming back here. The police are long gone. It's time to get on the road as soon as I'm done here. Just as I'm going down the hall, I run into that guy, Nick. He's got a toolkit in his hand and he almost drops it. Hi, I say. Somehow I don't want to tell him I'm leaving. Not yet. Nick nods at room 201.
Going to fix that leak.
Good luck, I say. He grunts. When I get back down into the lobby, it's eerily empty. The ceiling is still leaking into that bucket. Every time there's a drip of water, I hear a noise. Plunk, plunk, plunk. Good thing he's getting that fixed. It's going to destroy the ceiling. Rob always talks about how people don't call him fast enough for a leak and then they wreck the ceiling. He can fix the leak, but he can't fix that. But that's not my problem. Quinn is my only problem. I drop the keys to my room on the desk next to where he left his cell phone behind. He's awfully trusting to leave that sitting there. Anyway, he'll get the idea that I left. That's $50 down the drain. Well, $48. When I get out of the motel, the temperature is about 20 degrees colder than it was when I first came in. The wind hits me in the face and I regret not having brought a scarf. What's wrong with me? I've lived in New Hampshire my whole life. I know how cold it gets. Rosalie's. Find Rosalie's. Rosalie's what? What the hell was that old woman talking about? I scanned the outside of the hotel. I parked my car all the way in the back of the lot. I look up and see the old house next to the motel. That one light on the second floor that's still on. And the silhouette is still in the window, like she hasn't moved one inch since the last time I looked. Is that Rosalie? Is she watching me? I swivel my head to the other side to check out that old abandoned building. It looks like it used to be a restaurant, but now it's all boarded up. I squint into the darkness, and I can just make out a sign on the restaurant that is caked in dirt and snow. I can't quite see what it says. I trudge through the snow to get a closer look. It's only when I'm a stone throw away that I can see the writing, but I still can't make it out. I've got to get a little closer. I inch forward on the ground, which is now lined with ice. I don't want to slip and break my wrist, but I need to see what the sign says. It isn't until I'm about 6 feet away that I can finally read the writing. Rosalie's. I shiver and hug my purse. This is the place Greta was talking about. Did Quinn go inside? I make my way over to the front door of the abandoned restaurant. The door is not just closed, but boarded up. I cup my hands around my eyes, squinting to see inside. But it's completely dark. There are no signs of movement. But Greta said to come here. What was she talking about? I walk around the side of Rosalie's. I'm going very slowly because of how slippery the ice is. I have to hold on to the side of the restaurant to keep from slipping. It isn't until I get around the back that I see something blue peeking out from behind a garbage bin. I hurry over as fast as I dare. When I'm about 10 feet away, I can make it out clearly. It's a Corolla. Quinn's car. That's what Greta was talking about. She knew Quinn wasn't at the motel anymore, but she knew she hadn't left because her car is still here. Although God knows how she knew the car was here, considering how well concealed it is. You can't see it from the motel. I walk the rest of the way to the car. When I get over to the car, I grab onto it so as not to fall. I look inside, but unsurprisingly, the car is empty. A gust of wind nearly knocks me off my feet. My eyes are tearing from the cold, or maybe from something else. I look up. I can still see that broken-down old house with the one light on in the upstairs bedroom. From that house, you can see everything. You can see the parking lot of the motel. You can see Quinn's car behind the restaurant. And you can see through the window of room 203. The police were here looking for her, and Nick lied to them. For her. That was nice of him. It was. But Rosalie did not like it. Rosalie. I've got to talk to her. But one thing is for sure, I'm not going to end up like my sister. I'm smarter than that. I feel around in my purse until my fingers make contact with their destination, Rob's pocket knife. My heart is pounding as I carefully walk the distance from the restaurant to the dilapidated old house, my boots crunching against the hardening snow. Even though the snow has stopped, the wind is brutal, like an ice-cold dagger in my face. Every few seconds, I glance up at the second-floor window of the house. The light is still shining. Rosalie has not moved, not a millimeter. She is still in the window, staring down at me. I squint up at her, trying to make out any features. But I can't. My legs feel like rubber as I reach the small house. The door is made of wood, which has splintered over the years, and nobody bothered to fix it. The paint surrounding the door is outright peeling off. Like our house, it's a fixer-upper that nobody bothered to fix. I swallow a lump in my throat. Maybe this is a mistake. Maybe I should turn around and leave. I feel the weight of the knife in my hand. It gives me confidence. I've never let anyone push me around. I can deal with one small woman. Right? I knock on the door with my left hand. There's no answer. Rosalie isn't coming down. I suppose I'm not surprised. I put my hand on the doorknob.
I let out a gasp as it turns. The door is unlocked.
I push open the door and walk inside. Chapter 26. Rosalie. I'm not dead. Did you think I was? That I'm some corpse my husband propped up in front of the second floor window to frighten his guests? I'm not. I'm very much alive. And I'm afraid my husband is a murderer. 12 years earlier. I can hear the hum of the engine, and my body jolts with every imperfection in the road. My teeth sink into my lower lip as I shift in the passenger seat of the broken-down Ford. A blindfold covers my eyes, shrouding me in darkness. I desperately claw at the blindfold with my right hand. Before I can work it loose, a powerful hand encircles my wrist. My boyfriend Nick's voice cuts through the silence.
Hey, quit doing that,
he says. I groan. Nick?
I mean it. I want this to be a surprise. No peeking.
Fine. How much longer?
10 minutes, tops.
At 9 minutes and 30 seconds, I'm ripping this blindfold off. I swear, Nick. I have been dating Nick Baxter for 6 years. We met in high school, if you can believe that. High school sweethearts. I know. I never imagined meeting the love of my life in high school. But the second I kissed him at only 16 years old, I just knew. This was the guy. Have you ever just met somebody that you clicked with? That you felt was an extension of yourself? The missing piece? From the first moment we sat down to dinner on our first date, I felt like I could tell him anything. And I did. I told him I didn't want to be a teacher like my parents kept telling me to be. I wanted to be a chef. I wanted to open my own restaurant. It was my dream. I fell in love with him for being the only one to believe in me. Also, it doesn't hurt that he's pretty hot. Even with my eyes blindfolded, I can picture his dark blonde hair, his slim but muscular build, and his infectious smile. Girls always give Nick a second look, but he only has eyes for me. Whether I deserve it or not, he worships the ground I walk on. I feel the car swerving to the right, which means he is exiting the highway. Thank God. If we don't get there soon, I swear I'm going to vomit. If that happens, he's going to have to clean it up all by himself, because this is his own damn fault. The car jerks to a halt. Nick's warm, large hand squeezes my knee. I can imagine the eager look on his face.
Okay, Rosie. We're here.
Can I take off the blindfold?
Give me 1 minute.
He insists on guiding me out of the car. He rests his hand on top of my head to make sure I don't bump my head on the doorframe. He places his hands on my shoulders and turns me about 90 degrees. Then he yanks off the blindfold.
Ta-da!
He says. I blink, adjusting to the light. Ta-da what?
It's your new restaurant.
My new restaurant? Is he joking with me? I've been working as a line cook at a dingy restaurant since graduating culinary school. The salary is just barely enough that I could give up my waitressing job, since my parents have not given me one penny to subsidize my ridiculous lifestyle. Nick recently graduated from college with a degree in business, and he's been talking about the two of us starting a restaurant. I said sure, figuring it was just a pipe dream. And now, We are standing in front of a one-story building that looks like it should be condemned. All the windows are cracked. There's dirt ground into every single crack and crevice, and the door is literally hanging by one hinge. As I stare at the place, a rat scurries out the front door. I'm sure there are plenty more where that one came from. This place is horrible. It is not a good surprise. I feel like the blindfold was unnecessary. Oh, I say. I'm trying to look happy, but it's straining my acting skills.
I know it doesn't look great now,
he says quickly,
but I got it dirt cheap. Trust me, Rosie, this is a great location. I scoped it out, and there are no restaurants along I-93 for 20 minutes in either direction.
Mmm, I say.
I'm going to help you get it cleaned up, he says, and you'll see, this place is going to be a huge success. I promise.
Hmm, I say again. He looks me straight in the eyes.
This is your dream. I'm going to make it happen for you.
He sounds so sure of himself. I love Nick, but I think he overextended himself with this one. But I'll go along with it. After all, what do I have to lose? 9 years earlier. It feels decadent to be taking a day off. It's all I do anymore. Work. The restaurant opens for lunch, and I'm usually there till it closes late in the evening. I recently hired help so that I could at least have one night off, only after Nick bugged me to do it. I don't trust anyone to do as good a job as I do, and also, I love being there. I love being in the kitchen of my own restaurant. It's everything I ever wanted. But today I have a day off, and Nick persuaded me to go to a local carnival. We rode on the roller coaster, then on the Ferris wheel, and now we're sharing a giant blob of pink cotton candy.
I forgot how good cotton candy is,
Nick says as he stuffs a big fuzzy wad of it into his mouth.
You should serve this in the restaurant.
No.
You should. It will probably become your best-selling dessert.
I give him the side eye. I'm not even sure you're kidding.
I'm not.
I'm still somewhat in disbelief over how successful our restaurant has become. I'm not going to lie. The first year was rough. It took forever to get Rosalie's cleaned up and in condition to serve as a restaurant. Nick and I worked our butts off. We replaced all the windows, cleaned everything out by hand, bought all new kitchen appliances and furniture for the dining area. We invested a lot of money and a lot of labor. And for the first few months, I thought it was all going to be for nothing. I could count on one hand the number of customers on a given week. There were about 20 times that first year when I thought about giving up. I'm not sure what Nick did, but our business picked up at the end of that first year. We started getting steady customers, and the second year we broke even. The third year, we turned a profit. Then, a few months ago, Nick bought the two houses next door, one for us to live in and the other to turn into a motel. So we're going to buy a house together, I said when he told me his plans. That sounds pretty serious. We're not even married.
Well, we should probably do something about that, he said.
The bastard had a ring in his pocket. I said yes, obviously. I couldn't imagine spending my life with anyone else. We're getting married next month. It will be a small ceremony at City Hall, just close family, mostly because all of our money has been sunk into the restaurant and the new motel. And also, neither of us have big families. Plus, my parents don't like Nick. My mother is never clear about why, but she always hints that I could do better, and she doesn't think much of our restaurant either. That's why I don't speak to her much anymore. I'm not even sure she's coming to the wedding.
I'll let the cotton candy idea percolate, Nick says. In the meantime, what do you want to ride next? Should we ride that one that turns you around in a circle in the air and then upside down?
I look at the ride he's pointing to. Just the sight of it makes my stomach turn. No, thank you. How about... I look over at a little black tent with the sign on the front with painted black lettering that reads, Fortune Telling, 3 tickets. Oh, I want to get my fortune told. Nick snorts.
You don't need to go to a fortune teller to know your fortune. I can tell it to you right now.
He presses his fingertips into his temples.
The future is saying you're going to marry a super handsome business genius, and then you're going to have 5 kids together.
Are you sure the future is saying 5 kids? Because I'm kind of feeling like it might be 3.
Pretty sure it's 5.
We have always talked about having kids in an abstract sort of way, but now that we're actually getting married, these talks have become a little more serious. We both want a lot of kids. We're both only children, and we've always wanted big families. But 5 seems like an awful lot, and he's not the one who has to push them out. See, I say, this is why I need to talk to the fortune teller, and in the meantime, you can try to win me a decent prize this time. Earlier in the day, Nick played a game where he had to knock down bottles with a ball. He did spectacularly badly and insisted the game was rigged. Anyway, he won me a tiny rubber duck, which wasn't really worth carrying around, so I tossed it. Nick salutes.
You got it. I'm winning you a stuffed animal so big, one of us will have to ride on top of a hood on the way home.
That remains to be seen. While Nick goes to find his game of choice, I walk toward the black tent. I've never had my fortune told before, but it always seemed like fun. I don't believe in stuff like that, but there's no harm in it. The curtains of the tent are slightly parted, and I push them aside with my hand and peek my head in. The tent is lit by only a few candles, but it's enough to see the contents. There's a small wooden table inside, and a folding chair on either side of it. On one of the 2 chairs sits a woman with long black hair, and by black, I mean black. I've heard black described as the absence of color, but I never understood that description until I saw this woman's hair. She raises her eyes to look at me, and they're just as black as her hair. So black that I could not possibly see her pupils.
Hello,
she says.
Hi. My voice cracks unexpectedly and I clear my throat. You do fortune telling? She nods and gestures at the folding chair across from her.
Please have a seat.
I hand over my 3 tickets, which she stuffs into the purple robe she's wearing. I study her features, partially obscured by the shadows. I can't tell how old she is. She could be 20 or she could be 60. It's so strange.
My name is Naomi,
she says. I'm Rosalie.
That's a pretty name.
Her black eyes flit down to my left hand.
And that's a pretty ring.
I squeeze my left hand into a fist subconsciously. The diamond is tiny, all we could afford, but I love it. Yes, thank you.
He is a good man.
She says it like it isn't a question.
At least, you believe he is a good man.
He is, I say, with fierce loyalty. Something almost resembling a smile touches Naomi's lips.
We shall see.
She picks up a deck of tarot cards. I've seen tarot cards before, but I've never had my fortune read before. I know the whole thing is silly, but my stomach churns. I wish I had stayed outside and cheered Nick on while he won me another prize, or failed to win me another prize. She lays 3 cards out on the table. She stares down at the cards for a moment, her fingers lingering on the middle card, which is a tower on fire after being struck by lightning, with two men hurling downward to their death. I know nothing about tarot cards, but this doesn't look good. What? I say.
This is the tower,
she says.
It means you will have a life-altering revelation, one that will leave you blindsided.
I shake my head. Like what? Maybe I'm pregnant. My period isn't due till next week, but I forgot to take my pill a couple of nights this month. Nick would love that. Naomi touches the rightmost card. This one is even more disturbing. It's a picture of a knight riding a horse with a dead person below the horse's feet, except the knight's helmet is raised and you can see it is actually a skeleton. I can make out the word on the card. Death. Naomi raises her eyes sharply. She reaches out and grabs my wrist with fingers that are as cold as the skeleton on the card.
Rosalie, she hisses, you must not marry that man.
What? I try to yank my hand away, but she's holding tight. What are you talking about?
Please.
Her black eyes lock with mine.
You must listen to me. You think this man will bring you happiness, but he won't. He will bring death into your life.
Death? I repeat. You mean he's going to die? The thought of Nick dying is like a hand squeezing my heart. I can't imagine my life without him.
No,
she says firmly.
He will not die. He will bring the death of another.
You mean, my head is spinning, he's going to kill someone? She is silent. She releases my hand, but I'm too stunned to move. God! I shake my head. This is preposterous. I don't believe in this stuff, but there's something about this woman. You don't know Nick. He's a good guy, and he would never hurt anyone, ever. And I love him a lot.
But that will change.
No, it won't. I glare down at the cards in front of her. So basically, you flip over a tower and a skeleton, and then you say that my fiancé is a murderer? This is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
It is not just the picture on the card.
Her voice is quiet.
It is what the cards say to me. This is the gift I have.
She frowns at me.
You still have time. You can call it off.
I open my mouth to tell her off, to say that there is no way in hell I would ever break up with the man I love because of some psychic at a stupid carnival. But somehow, no words come out.
Think about it, Rosalie,
she says.
I can only show you the right path. You must choose to walk it.
My hands are shaking when I get out of the psychic's tent. It was so dark in there that the sunlight startles me. I blink a few times as my eyes adjust.
I did it.
I turn around and find Nick holding up a stuffed panda triumphantly. It's about a foot tall, so not so big that it won't fit in the back seat, but admittedly more impressive than that rubber duck. He has an adorably proud grin on his face, and I throw my arms around his neck, and I can't seem to let go.
Whoa!
He laughs.
I didn't know you were such a fan of pandas.
But when I pull away from him, the smile drops off his face. It's only then that I realize there are tears streaking down my cheeks.
Rosie, what's wrong?
He asks.
Are you okay?
I blink back fresh tears. I'm fine.
You're not fine. He glances at the black tent. What the hell happened in there?
She... I take a shaky breath. I hadn't meant to tell him what Naomi said to me or let it ruin my day, but I can't help myself. She told me something bad would happen if we got married, that we should call off the wedding. His mouth drops open.
Are you kidding me? She said that to you?
I nod slowly. He shoves the panda into my hands.
That is unacceptable. I'm going to talk to her.
I grab his arm. Nick, please don't.
But she upset you.
A muscle twitches in his jaw.
She has some nerve. She's just some cheap carnival fake psychic. You know nothing she says is real, right? It's all just a show.
Right.
Rosie.
His brown eyes are wide.
You're not really taking this seriously, right? She's not psychic. That's not even a real thing.
I know.
And I love you.
He reaches out and grabs my hand in his.
If we didn't get married, I don't know what I would do. There's no one else I would ever want to spend my life with.
I swallow down a lump in my throat. I love you too.
I mean,
he says,
that psychic said something bad would happen if we got married, but I honestly can't imagine anything worse than not being with you.
I feel the same way. I know.
So,
one side of his lips quirks up.
You won't break up with me because of what that psychic said?
I allow myself a teeny tiny smile. I guess not. He kisses me, squishing the stuffed panda between us. I try to enjoy it, but I can't quite push away what that psychic told me. I don't believe in this stuff. I know it's fake. But I can't stop seeing the frightened look in her eyes.
Chapter 27. 6 years earlier.
You don't even realize you have everything until your whole life falls apart. I've been married to Nick for 3 years now. I married him as planned, despite the psychic's warning, and surprise, surprise, nothing horrible happened. Nick never murdered anyone. He's been a pretty great husband, all things considered, and for a long time, our lives were good. Rosalie's is thriving, and even the motel is turning a nice profit. We were fixing up the house we live in, a monster job, but we got sidetracked because I got pregnant. We were waiting for our businesses to be a bit more stable and to finish our renovation work on the house, even though Nick was keen to get a move on and have our 5 babies. Yeah, right. Finally, he persuaded me to go off birth control, and on our very first try, we made a baby. Then, only 2 weeks after my positive pregnancy test, the bleeding started. Nick took it worse than I did. He was so excited about starting a family, and he had already been suggesting terrible baby names. I was sad about it, too, but I had read how common early pregnancy losses are, especially for a first pregnancy. I was sad, but I knew we would try again. Then, a week after my miscarriage, I woke up unable to feel my right foot. Now it's 4 months later. I'm sitting in the office of a neurologist named Dr. Heller, a tall, thin woman with half-moon glasses that rest low on the bridge of her nose. She has 2 armchairs set up in front of her desk. Nick is sitting in one, and I'm in the other. My cane is leaning against the desk because I would fall if I tried to walk without it. And Dr. Heller has just uttered 2 words that will completely change my life.
Multiple sclerosis?
Nick blurts out. His face looks how mine feels.
Are you sure?
Yes,
she says simply.
Technically, you need to be having symptoms for 1 year to make this diagnosis, but I feel fairly certain.
And unfortunately, you have a primary progressive form of the disease, since your neurological symptoms have gotten no better, even with the steroids, and have, in fact, progressed.
She's right. The symptoms have not gotten better, not even a little bit. They have progressed. The numbness has spread to my other foot.
So what's the treatment?
He asks.
With primary progressive multiple sclerosis, there's no proven treatment,
she says.
We can try some medications, but...
No treatment. There's nothing we can do. I will continue to progress. Nick shakes his head.
I don't understand how this happened. She doesn't have any weird neurological diseases in her family.
It doesn't always run in families,
Dr. Heller says.
It's possible, in your case, the pregnancy triggered it. And there's a chance that if you get pregnant again, your symptoms could get worse.
A chance,
he repeats.
So it's not for sure?
No, she says. It's uncertain, especially since Rosalie has a much less common form of the disease, but you should be aware of the possibility.
We return home after that appointment, both of us visibly shaken. Nick hardly says a word the entire drive home. That muscle twitches in his jaw the way it always does when he's upset. I spend most of the drive staring out the window, trying to figure out what's going to happen for the rest of my life. The tower card. The life-altering revelation. Multiple sclerosis. The end of life as I know it. It's come true. When we walk into our house, I sit down at the kitchen table, but Nick just stands there. He doesn't say anything for several seconds, but it's obvious he has something to say. I look up at him, waiting, and then he says it.
So it's just a possibility, right?
He folds his arms across his chest.
That doesn't mean if you get pregnant again, you're definitely going to get worse.
I knew that's what he was thinking. I knew it. But I wasn't sure if he would have the gall to say it. I mean, it's easy for him to be glib about it. He's not the one whose body is literally attacking itself. I glare at him. So, you're okay with taking that chance? His face falls.
Rosie, you want a family too, don't you? I thought we were on the same page. 5 kids, right?
I can't even joke about it. There's nothing funny about what's happening to us right now. I'm not willing to sacrifice everything for it, though.
Yes, but...
His voice drops.
Our family is everything, too.
So I'm not enough for you?
No, no.
He pinches the bridge of his nose.
It's just... It's a lot to give up, you know?
Of course I know. I've wanted to be a mother my whole life. But over the last 4 months, I've been learning how hard it is to walk without being able to feel my feet. If this gets worse, I don't know what will happen. I don't know how I'll be able to run the restaurant, and I certainly don't know how I'll be able to run after a bunch of kids. I'm sorry. I say, I just can't risk it.
But the answer is no, Nick. I won't change my mind.
He looks stricken. He collapses into a chair across from me.
Okay.
There's a lump in my throat. He's right. It's a lot to give up. And he's always wanted to have kids so badly. It's not right to ask this of him. Listen, I reach for his hand and he gives it to me reluctantly. I love you, but I understand if you want to. If this is too much for you, I would understand. We don't have to be together if you don't want to be anymore. Nick jerks his head back,
What are you talking about? You think I want to break up?
I'm just saying I would understand.
He squeezes my hand firmly in his.
Look, I'm not thrilled about this, obviously. But I love you. And there's nothing that would make me not want to be with you anymore.
We sit together in the kitchen for a long time, holding hands and contemplating what the rest of our lives will be like together. I have no idea at that moment how bad things are going to get.
4 years earlier.
I hate the ceiling of our bedroom. We had it painted when we moved in, but it's covered in cracks. Whoever painted it did a terrible job. The cracks are all over the place, forming spiderweb patterns in the white plaster. It needs to be redone, but let's face it, that's the least of our problems. It doesn't even make the top 20.
Rosie?
I didn't even realize the sound of the shower had turned off. I shut my eyes, feeling that familiar wave of fatigue wash over me. I slept all night, but I'm still exhausted. When the alarm went off 10 minutes ago, I woke up to shut it off, but I felt far from ready to get out of bed.
Rosie?
Nick is out of the shower. His dark blonde hair looks even darker from the water, and he has a towel wrapped around his waist, revealing a pretty nice upper body. He looks really good. Every bit as handsome as the day I fell in love with him. Maybe more. He's grown up from that 16-year-old boy. I don't want to think about what he must see when he looks at me now.
Hey, Rosie,
he says.
I got the bench set up in the shower for you if you want to go in.
He grabs my walker and brings it to the side of the bed. I never got pregnant again, but it didn't matter. My legs got weaker anyway, even faster than Dr. Heller predicted. I went from a cane to crutches, and now I use a walker most of the time. At my appointment last week, Dr. Heller wrote a prescription for a wheelchair. I'm still working at the restaurant, but it's gotten very difficult. I'm struggling. It's not just that I'm having difficulty walking and getting around. My brain is muddled. I mix up orders and forget what I'm doing in the middle of doing it. It's embarrassing.
Rosie, do you need help sitting up?
I stare at him. I have to get up and get to the restaurant, to my job that I love, that I dreamed of all my life, except I just don't want to. The idea of getting out of bed, taking a shower, getting dressed, even running a comb through my hair is so exhausting. I can't even contemplate it. I'm not getting up, I say. He frowns.
Are you sick?
He's so damn nice about everything, so willing to help me with every little thing. I used to love that about him. I never realized until recently how annoying it could be. Yes, I'm sick. He sits down on the edge of the bed. He reaches for my forehead and I swat him away.
What's wrong?
I have multiple sclerosis. He rolls his eyes.
Come on, get up. There are going to be customers waiting outside.
No.
I don't understand.
I don't want to work at the restaurant anymore. He tries again to